All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly broadcasting live from the Internet Law Center here in downtown Santa Monica, the heart of Silicon Beach. Please be seated. We have a great show for you today. I just got back from Sacramento where we had a victory in scaling back a dangerous email bill put forth by Dan Balsam that we'll be talking about on another show. But today is a special show. On June 5th, in a packed ballroom at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, Robert Kennedy stood victorious in the California Democratic primary for president. He finished his speech saying, "Now on to Chicago, and let's win there." A few moments later, he was fatally wounded and died that night. Now, I was 5 years old, and that is my very first political memory. I remember running home from Little League to watch the funeral. And growing up in an Irish Catholic family in New England at that time, it is hard to convey just how omnipresent the Kennedys and their legacy were. He had always been a hero of mine. And so now, on the 50th anniversary of that tragic day, it is my great pleasure and honor to have my favorite law school professor, Peter Edelman, and who was a former Bobby Kennedy aide and friend, to join us to discuss his legacy. Professor Edelman is a professor at Georgetown University, and he worked with Bobby, starting with the Justice Department all the way through the campaign, and continuing even after his death, working with the Robert F. Kennedy Memorial Human Rights Foundation, and even later working with Ted Kennedy's 1980 campaign, which was my first presidential campaign. And so, Professor Edelman, I'm very glad to have you.
Oh, I'm so glad to be with you, Bennett. It's terrific.
So, I guess let's just start at the beginning. You were out of law school, you clerked with Supreme Court Justice Goldberg, and you got a job as a young lawyer working at the Justice Department. What exactly were you doing?
I was a special assistant under a man named John Douglas, whose father was a great senator from the state of Illinois, Paul Douglas. John was the assistant attorney general on the civil division. It was a great job. I sat with him with the senior people in talking about all of the priorities in the civil division, and I got a chance to do a couple of cases in the course of the year. And then when there were major things, like there was a railroad strike that happened in that period of time, John needed somebody to do something very quickly, and I was allowed to write a brief on that. There was a situation where a civil rights division lawyer was arrested by some law enforcement in the state of Alabama, saying that person was there without having a license to practice in Alabama, which of course is absolutely stupid and wrong, but that doesn't matter. And I got to write a memo on that. So it was a great year, other than the fact that it was a terrible year.
Yeah, exactly.
Because two and a half months into that was when President Kennedy was killed.
And what was that like? I mean, I don't know to what extent did you have interaction with the Attorney General at that time?
Very little. I had met him when I was at the Supreme Court. He came and had lunch with us, and I sat next to him, and so he didn't know who I was, but I chatted with him a little bit. And then, of course, when he lost his brother, he was grieving, as we know, and he didn't come around very much for, oh gosh, a number of months. So he was always a hands-on person who walked the halls, and he would pop into somebody's office, and of course they would be terrified, and he would ask them what they were working on, and they would say something or other. So he, of course, during that period of time, he stopped. So I only, as far as a personal relationship, my recollection is I was invited up there with a bunch of lawyers who had been hired during that period, and so he was meeting people in groups of 10 or 15 or 20 lawyers. I was fortunate, having been there at the right time in the Department of Justice. I got interested in working in his campaign for the Senate, and because I was there, I was able to get a job in the campaign. And
How did that happen? You got the campaign job.
Well, you got to be in the right place in the right time. That's kind of it. I had taken the job at a law firm in New York. I never showed up. I don't know if my name is still on a door down there. But anyway, I said to my boss, John Douglas, who was very close to Robert Kennedy, that I was interested in working in the campaign if that could be worked out, and he worked it out.
Perfect.
So I and Adam Wilinski, who became my sort of partner as a legislative assistant, he got both of us, John got both of us into the campaign, and Adam was writing speeches and I was doing research. So that's how it was done, and it was quite fortunate and quite terrific.
And of course, it was a successful campaign, and from there you joined the Senate staff as a legislative aide.
Yes, and so it turned out I would have taken the job accepted anyway, but you know, I assumed that I would be reporting to somebody who would then be reporting to the senator, and all of those people, with one exception, who was the chief of staff, these were men in their 40s. They had to make money so they could pay the college costs and that sort of thing, and it turned out that Adam and I were reporting from day one. Reporting directly to Robert Kennedy, and not expected, and quite terrific.
Definitely. And so what is one of your earliest memories in working in the Senate?
The first thing that I remember that I was specifically involved in was that President Johnson decided to close a bunch of veterans hospitals. And for reasons that we thought were suspect, three of them were going to be in New York State. And we thought that was not an accident. President Johnson and Robert Kennedy had hooked in hostility quite a while before that. So I was assigned to work to see if we could make that stop, make not happen. And I got connected to the head of the VA because he was, of course, working for Johnson, but he didn't want these things closed. So we had a sort of under the table discussion about strategy and so on. And I did everything, things that I thought up, things that Senator told me to do, to put pressure on and to be supportive to people who from the community and who worked in these three places and make as much noise as they could to anybody who could make a difference, basically the people in the Veterans Administration and the White House. So I got my, you know, I sort of got my feet wet doing that, and I didn't sort of know any better, so I yelled at a lot of people and made myself totally obnoxious, and I think we did some good.
a good lesson to learn. Now, you mentioned
I might have learned. I might have after that learned a little. Get to be a little more smooth. But anyway, yes.
So you mentioned earlier that the senator was when as attorney general he was grieving, and there seems to be this kind of arc of Bobby Kennedy from 1963 to eventually 68. Where he slowly is coming out of that and kind of finding himself in a new way. Where was he when he joined the Senate?
When he joined the Senate, he was pretty much what he was going to be as a senator. The arc starts and there's a lot of debate about this. Was he a bad guy? Then he became a good guy. Those arguments. And right. And it's of course clear that he was enormously affected by losing his brother. But there's a long history, there's no question he was a difficult person in the 1950s, brusque, things about Joe McCarthy, all that kind of stuff. But also personally, he could be very hard on people, so they say. And that was all gone by the time I met him. But what was there all the way through, starting in high school, he was always interested, connected to, relating to kids, to people who were on the edges in our country. So his friends, you could just see it in a lot of different things. And when he became attorney general, fresh from having gotten his brother to be president, the first thing he did as attorney general was to start, he put his high school friend David Hackett in charge of what turned into putting together the war on poverty. I mean, Robert Kennedy was really, really did the basic work through a set of people who David Hackett brought into it. So there was a lot of what he was going to be before.
There.
And then he loses his brother, which clearly is not only the deepening, but it's also now he's on by himself.
Right.
It's up to him now. He's his own person, as opposed to what he had to do in his responsibility with his brother. And when that became visible, him on his own, what you saw was a person who was deeply interested in poverty, deeply interested in race, deeply interested internationally in things like South Africa and getting rid of nuclear proliferation. And that was all there. Now, what happens in the course of this from the beginning of 1965 when he is sworn in, of course, is the development of the escalation of the Vietnam War.
Right.
And he was already having doubts about that. But, of course, that changes as the war gets worse. So there were things that, in relation to the events, made some changes in what he was pursuing and what he was saying. But the basic thing was there when I met him.
And I guess it's hard to ask this question, but but for Vietnam, would it seemed like Vietnam ultimately is what was the call that pushed him to run for president. But for that. Do you think he would have done that? But that's kind of a hard question to ask, envisioning this 1960s without Vietnam.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that that's hard. I would guess, pretty good guess, I think, that if there was no Vietnam, he would have waited in line. I'm sure he was intending to run sometime, but that would have been 1972. That's what I think would have happened on that.
So in 1966, you're on a plane and you have a conversation with a senator and he asks you the important question, why am I dragging myself out to California?
Yeah, drag my ass, he said.
In print, anyway, it's changed.
Yeah, that is what he said. So just as in line with our conversation, this is 66, so he's already been in there just since March, a little bit more than a year, but it's a terrific illustration of who the Robert Kennedy as Senate was. And so what had happened was I had a call, it just happened to be me, I guess it was maybe one of my issues, but from a man named Jack Conway, who was the right-hand man to Walter Reuther at the United Auto Workers. And Conway said to me that the Senate Migratory Labor Subcommittee, get that, that there was a subcommittee on migratory labor. Robert Kennedy was a member of that, and so Conway said Reuther would appreciate it if Kennedy would go to California and get national visibility, as he would, about the farm workers and success of having a union of farm workers. There'd never been a successful one, and this was the best possibility because Chavez was such a terrific leader and so charismatic and all of that. So I went into his office, and this was a thing about how he learned things. I mean, there's certainly many things, like talking about the development of his views about Vietnam. But there were a lot of other things where he was just intuitive. And I walked in there, and I said, I had this call from Jack Conway, and Walter Reuther would like you to go. And he said, fine. And I'm saying to myself, fine, don't you want to ask me anything more than that? I maybe said a couple sentences more, but he didn't need it. He got it. Except when we got the point of the quote in your question is he gets to the plane, and we're on the plane, and we have taken off. And it has apparently not sunk into his head about why we were doing this. So he said, why the hell am I dragging my ass all the way to the other side of the country? And then he gets there, and this is the really important thing. He gets right into it. There was this remarkable story, which you probably know, Bennett, but... The sheriff
yes.
is testifying as we walk in, right? You know the story. So Kennedy sits down and he's sort of getting his, getting what's going on. And he hears the Senate, the sheriff saying, so I arrest them to protect them. And Kennedy says, what? He said, "Do you is there any crime? You arrest them to protect them." He says, "I'm not like the sheriff in Mississippi. I don't want anybody hurt here." And Kennedy says again, "What's the crime? Is there any crime? Are they trespassing? No, they're on the side of the road. And so you're arresting them when they haven't done any crime." And then he says, "Sheriff, it's lunchtime here, so we're going to take a break. And while you're having lunch, I would like you to read the Constitution of the United States." And of course, the place goes up because the audience there are all farm workers and people who support the farm workers. Very few people are growers and so on. So anyway, that's the story. And that's when he meets Cesar Chavez right after in that lunching break, and they find each other in the parking lot and they start talking, and very just instantaneously they become friends, really friends till death.
And it's become a very important friendship in a couple of years. But we're going to take a short break, and we come back. We're going to talk about the senator's trip to Mississippi. You're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Are you looking for the best in WordPress speed, security, and scalability? WP Engine is a digital experience platform for WordPress, powering digital experiences for large brands around the world. With easy-to-use site management tools and powerful do-it-your-way development features, WP Engine gives you the flexibility to build it your way. Improve your SEO and conversion rates with a faster site on WP Engine. Learn more on WPEngine.com.
Looking for a better way to get more traffic and interaction to your Facebook page? Imagine Facebook interactivity on your page like you've never seen. Introducing your new Facebook marketing fix, Zo Social, the new and revolutionary way to easily manage and automate your Facebook contests and sweepstakes. Create a fun, easy-to-win contest by writing a simple Facebook post. Watch your post go more viral and generate loads of interaction. Track your traffic and generate email lists with ease. Zo Social is mobile-friendly and complies with Facebook terms of service. Let Zo Social give your Facebook page some flash today. Zoom over to zosocial.com.
A more refreshing kind of talk radio.
WebmasterRadio.fm. We're everywhere.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back, and we're talking with Georgetown Professor Peter Edelman about Bobby Kennedy 50 years later. And so we just finished talking about his first meeting with Cesar Chavez. And the next year, 1967, at a Senate hearing on the war on poverty, a young 27-year-old lawyer from the NAACP in Mississippi, Marion Wright, invited the senator to come down to the Mississippi Delta to see the poverty there. And Professor Edelman joined the senator in that trip. And can you tell us about that?
One of my the major work that I gradually focused on was about poverty and a lot about race. We were doing hearings all over the country because it was necessary to reauthorize the Economic Opportunity Act, which was the legislation that is we call the War on Poverty. And there was a lot of politics about that, and the committee wanted to go around the country and shore up support for it in cities and in rural areas, Indian reservations, all of that. So one place that we that the committee decided wanted to go was to Mississippi, because there was a Head Start program there that was in fact the largest in the country, and the state government had refused to take the federal money, and so the feds had directly sent the money down to a nonprofit that was independent of the state, and therefore a big nuisance, or worse from the point of view of the power brokers of the state. And so they were making as much trouble as they can, and the point was to get national visibility for that very large, it was the largest employer in the state, and it operated in 21 counties, so it was really a big thing. Well, we got down there, and the person and I had come a couple days earlier and had gotten in touch with her and had talked with her, had dinner with her, and so on, was Marion Wright, to whom I'm now married. She told the committee when she testified that, well, yes, there were these issues about CDGM, that's the acronym for the Head Start, but she said, I really want to call your attention to the fact that we have now in Mississippi families, children, who are severely malnourished, really just an awful situation of hunger there. And so we went up to the Mississippi Delta, the committee did, and Marion was kind of along with a man named Amzi Moore, who was a postman, but also very, very lively civil rights lawyer in Cleveland, Mississippi. So he took us to see these families, and it was just stunning. There were children who were brought, the families brought them out and stood in front of their shacks, and there were cameras and so on. And you saw these children who were in rags and who had swollen bellies and sores on their legs and arms that weren't getting any better, and it was just awful. And Kennedy's, and he talked, because he talked to the kids, and he listened to the kids, really listened to the kids, and asked them what they had to eat, and of course the answers were not much. They hadn't had breakfast and that sort of thing. Going into the houses and seeing there was nothing in the whether it was an ice box or a refrigerator, mostly ice box, I think. So he was walking with me across to the next house, and he said to me, "I've never seen anything like this." He says, "Worse than places I've been in, fourth world places." And maybe that was a little overstated, but all of us were so shocked by what we had seen. He just, when he came home, and this is the way he always operated, when he met Cesar Chavez, he became Cesar Chavez's representative, and I did the staff work, for the farm workers in Washington, in the Department of Labor and elsewhere. And similarly here, his immediate step was to go to the Secretary of Agriculture and say, "You've got to get some food down there." And as long as he was alive, which was another slightly more than a year, he spent a tremendous amount of time trying to make the question of hunger into a national issue that would have some results to stop this. And this is what happened with him. Time after time, he would there'd be something that he would learn about, that he would see, and add to the list. Nothing ever went off the list, but especially the question of hunger, which was so shocking. And when he comes to campaigning for president, he talked about hunger in Mississippi every place he went because he thought it was so shocking, and also that people should know about it.
Right. This is America. This shouldn't be the case.
Yeah.
Now, you would later tell the senator you think he should run for president. Why was that? And what was his first reaction?
That he should run for president?
Yeah.
Well, this starts in the fall of 67. Allard Lowenstein, who was an activist and somebody that the senator, all of us, knew quite well, And Robert Kennedy didn't agree to do it. Lowenstein was saying, "We've got to have somebody who will run against Lyndon Johnson." Robert Kennedy didn't agree to do it, which was very unfortunate. But I know he was very, very torn. He kind of had two different things tearing at each other. One was that one part of him was from the old politics, got his president, his brother elected president.
Yeah, he was a former campaign manager at heart, yeah.
He was his campaign manager. I mean, they talk about ruthless. You've got to be a tough guy. And one of the reasons why, along with all of his caring about people who marginalized in our country, he had this other side, and they all worked together. But he was also very tough. And so in relation to running for president, that was saying his father, the way he had done everything up to that time was, you don't do things that you can't win. Only do things if you are going to win them. And then, you know, this is the time when we have cause politics, and that's the other part of his brain. And that says you do it on principle. It doesn't matter whether you're going to win or lose, because it's so important. You have to try. You have to take it up and do it. And so ultimately, and there were steps along the way, but because TET came along, the TET offensive, at the end of January, which really turned everything.
Yes.
And so finally, just before, and I was with him 2 days before the primary in New Hampshire in March 12th, March 10th, I was with him because, again, Cesar Chavez, he had been doing a hunger strike. Chavez's people had called me and said that Cesar says he won't start eating unless Robert Kennedy comes and breaks bread with him. And Kennedy said, well, he would come. And on the way to there on that Sunday, he asked two of his closest friends and former colleagues, John Siegenthaler and Ed Guthman, and I was there. And we were on a plane flying from Los Angeles up to the valley there, Delano, and he told us he was going to run for president. So he had finally worked it through and decided that he just had to do it and would do it. And so the following Saturday, he announced that he was running.
And you got involved in the campaign, and it was a short 82 days.
85, yeah.
What stands out to you of the campaign?
Oh,
that
gosh.
You remember? Happened. I mean, but
yeah. Well, that's one thing.
Were you in during that the day King died?
Was I what?
Were you in Indianapolis the night King died?
No. For the first 6 weeks or so of the campaign, I was running the staff back in the headquarters. Adam Walensky and Jeff Greenfield were on the plane. And then they decided about halfway through the campaign that they needed me more out there with them, and I got somebody else to run that staff. So I saw it firsthand out there for the last 6 weeks of it. Well, what it was like, he, and you have to understand, I mean, you did say, and listeners have to understand how fast this all happened. So March 16th, he announces that he's running. As a result of that, Johnson goes out after 2 weeks. Doesn't want to be up against Kennedy. So that 2 weeks are one sort of chapter. And Kennedy is he's like somebody let him out of a cage. He's just passionate because it's all been penned in there for probably for years with regard to Johnson. These were very, very, not only passionate, but very strong in their criticism of Johnson. And he was getting these phenomenal crowds, 18,000, people in Kansas, in a football stadium in Kansas.
Wow.
In fact, in two places, the University of Kansas and Kansas State. And it's like that. Well, then in 2 weeks, it's gone. And Kennedy, one of the things about Kennedy is for all of his sort of toughness and how he believes so strongly in the issues, he also had this feeling, which was true when he ran in 1964 for the Senate. He rather liked his opponent, Kenneth Keating, and one of the things that sort of slowed him down to get up to being very strong then, and learning how to campaign, really, was Keating. And then Keating did a couple things that pissed off Kennedy. Anyway, he found his balance then. And similarly here on May 30th, it's going to be Humphrey. He likes Humphrey. I mean, he understands that Humphrey's associated with the Vietnam War, so it's nothing about that. But then, as he's working that out, 5 days later, Dr. King is killed.
Wow.
So, 5 days. And then after that, somehow one of the results of Kennedy is he finds his balance there. And some of it is, I think he's taking up some of the responsibility from King. And it, anyway, it just gets him very, very focused. And so from there in early April, in other words, about 2 months, Kennedy is quite clear on what he's saying, and he's got the whole the purpose and the strategy, I think. And what that turns into, and there's a good book by a man named Thurston Clark about the campaign, and it's very well documented. He says it doesn't matter where he goes. He talks about every place he goes. He says something about how glad he is to be an X. And you know, Ethel says, "I hope you go out there on the campaign and you go to X." And I mean, you know, he would kind of make fun, and everybody would love that. But he always talked to whether it was white, black, whether it was urban, whether it was rural. He would talk about the war, and he would talk about race and poverty, and he would talk about that particularly in talking about hunger in Mississippi, every place he went. And he also talked a lot about giving people a sense of having their own power in this democracy. He would say that to people, which it, you know, in an odd way, it's kind of what Trump said, except Robert Kennedy meant it, and he knew what he meant. So that was all clear. And one of the things that was very strong about the possibility that he would succeed is that people knew he was saying the same thing to everybody. And even when they disagreed with him, he was being honest and clear and sincere. And also the sort of tough side of him is they knew that not only that he meant what he said, but that he would be very committed to do something to get us to be the better kind of country that we should be.
I saw a clip with you speaking to med students, I think it was in Indiana, and they asked, well, who's going to pay for these programs? And he said, you.
He was
honest, and something no politician would do.
Right, and he also told those college students that if they were getting a pass, that they didn't have to go to the Army, that was wrong, that the fight was being done by people who weren't in college and were largely disproportionately people of color. And he took that right to those students, saying, you know, what you're doing, taking that, you're just wrong. And, you know, they disagreed, but they really had to respect that he came and said that.
So on June 5th, you left California and went to New York to prepare for, was New York going to be the final primary?
Yes, but I went home to Washington. I went to New York then when we had went for the funeral.
Okay. So you were, you went back to Washington, and you're getting ready to go to New York for the primary, and and you heard late that night. What was your reaction?
Yes, Marion and I, we skipped a little in the story of Marion and Peter here from my meeting her when I went down to Mississippi. I was telling you about hunger, but there was also a relationship that resulted in our getting married. We got married in July, and we were essentially engaged, or whatever you call it. And so we were in her apartment at 3 a.m., and we were lying on the floor, and the television was on, but we were more sleeping than not, and we heard this commotion, and of course that was he'd been shot. So that's how we found out about it. It was just, of course, just unspeakable.
And what was your reaction?
It's everything. I mean, it's a combination of somebody on a personal level that was very, very close, and what a what a tragedy for our country. It's all of that. And I will tell you, I mean, there's one other person in my life who I kept having in my dreams was my mother, who died when she was 43, and a little bit my father, who died when he was almost 90, but mostly my mother for years. And same thing, the only other person tells you how close this all was in my mind was Robert Kennedy.
Wow.
So it was really deep.
So we have to take our second break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more with Professor Edelman about what Bobby Kennedy means today after these messages. You're listening to the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Do you look at the task of ranking your site at the top of the search engines like you would climbing the top of Mount Everest? It doesn't have to be. TopSEOs.com knows how hard that climb can be, and they can make top ranking a reality. TopSEOs sends you to only the right search vendors and agencies that they know will work for you. Since 2002, TopSEOs.com has reviewed and researched the best search engine marketing agencies and solutions providers. Don't risk the cost of falling off the proverbial peak of search rankings. Let TopSEOs give you peace of mind. TopSEOs.com, the independent authority on search vendors.
Hi, I'm Montel Williams. Most of you know me as a talk show host, but I'm also an author, actor, single father of four, avid snowboarder, and I'm also a medical marijuana patient. Living with multiple sclerosis, I'm in pain every day. Medical marijuana is my last resort, and it helps me when all other drugs have failed. If you'd like more information about medical marijuana, you can contact the Marijuana Policy Project at mpp.org or call 1-877-JOIN-MPP.
Your virtual webmaster frat house.
Webmasterradio.fm. Hey, bring your togas.
Webmasterradio.fm.
Thanks for listening. Webmasterradio.fm. We're everywhere.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
And we're back, and we're talking with Professor Peter Edelman about Bobby Kennedy and the 50th anniversary of his assassination and campaign. And you were involved in the funeral. You helped write the eulogy and took the funeral train to Washington. And right now there's an exhibit traveling. I know it's in San Francisco, or was in San Francisco, about the funeral train. And just what a unique experience that was, people lining up all down the Eastern Corridor to watch the train. What was that like?
Well, on the one hand, it was just awful. Because
of course,
he was dead. That's on the one hand. And so in some sense, that was the overriding. But at the same time, of course, what was just astonishing was you had to see it, and all people of all ages and all everythings, black, white, brown, etc., in all different kind of signs and so on. It was just remarkable. Carrie Kennedy says, or one of the things in her new book, Ripples of Hope, that the passengers remembered five nuns standing on tiptoes in a yellow pickup truck, black militants holding up clenched fists, a white policeman cradling a black child in his arms, and a line of little leaguers standing at attention along the baselines, heads bowed and caps held over hearts.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so we've gone from that moment to a candidate who said, I run for the presidency because I want the United States to stand for the reconciliation of men, to Mr. Twitter Trump. And what does Bobby Kennedy say for today's politics?
What he would say if he were alive, I think we know. He would if he'd been alive all these years, whether he'd been president or not, but if he'd been serving and being part of our life, it's reasonable to think there wouldn't be a Trump for one reason or another.
True. And you do think he would have won? I know I got to meet Jeff Greenfield and talk to him about his book. And, you know, and then all hell broke. And then I forget the name of the title. And then everything happened. Where he kind of projected what might have happened had Bobby not been shot.
Yeah.
And he predicted he'd be a one-term president.
Yeah.
But, do you
well,
believe
you know, he's got a good imagination. We don't know. But here's what I think, just starting at the beginning, which is there is a case. It's a case that he would have been nominated. I think it's easier to hypothesize that he would have beat Nixon. But beating Humphrey is not something that you can say
automatic.
Was necessarily
yeah.
going to happen. But here's the case for it. He had won a bunch of primaries. He would have won New York as well. Now, that was a minority of states for sure at that time. And the decision would be by the power brokers. And the point is that people like Mayor Daley and Governor Hughes of New Jersey had actually indicated that they would be support him because it's just power. It's politics. It's
yeah.
it's. The point is who can win, and Humphrey's a loser. So and I had a couple weeks ago when I was out getting a little bit of media in all of this, a friend of mine that I grew up with in Minnesota wrote me and said he was a delegate in Chicago, and of course Minnesota, that's Humphrey.
Right.
And David said to me that their delegation was ready to go for Kennedy. He said,
wow.
"Don't believe these people saying that it couldn't be done." So that's what I think, without proof, obviously, but that he would be president. And even if he'd lost, then he could have run against Nixon in 72, et cetera. And the idea that if he'd been elected, he would. I mean, the theory of Greenfield is that Kennedy would have burned up all of his credits. He would have ended the Vietnam War. And he would have done all of the efforts that he could about race and poverty and so on, and he would have used up all his credits, and therefore he would have lost. That's the Greenfield theory. Anyway, that you can make these ideas.
Sure.
You can,
now, you wrote in the American Prospect, you have a piece about what Bobby Kennedy teachings for today, and just so for our listeners, as usual, on our show notes at cyberlawradio.wordpress.com, we have a full information about Professor Edelman and links to these articles and information about the campaign. You posit that a Kennedy presidency would have addressed certain things that, as you mentioned earlier, may not have eliminated what the factors that led to a Trump presidency. One, dealing with the racial disparity, and two, dealing with income disparity, and because the 70s were that moment in time when the Industrial Revolution was kind of shifting away in the United States, and we started having factory closings, and the economy was retooling, and some people were getting left behind, and that you believe that Kennedy might have had the foresight to address that. And one thing, I just want to go back to a conversation we had almost 10 years ago, that you stressed that what was unique about Bobby was that he wasn't liberal or conservative. He was a little bit of both. And, he would have seen a way to try to take the best from both to try to address issues of economic opportunity like he had done in Bedford Stuy and elsewhere.
Well, he certainly believed, to take that first and then come back to the bigger point, he believed very strongly in people having power, real people in communities, to have a lot more power over decisions that are made in our country. And he did that in terms of community action in the war on poverty and what he did in Bedford-Stuyvesant, the neighborhood in Brooklyn. So that was an approach that was not a traditional liberal thing. The bigger point, and that's important, the bigger point here, which I mentioned in that piece, is that if we're going to think about what happened to Robert Kennedy and about the country, we did have in beginning taking place probably late 60s, but quite noticeable in the early 70s to the changes in the deindustrialization that took place,
right,
where these plants went all over the world and left the United States and left people high and dry. And what happened is we had these high wage, terrific jobs that people had in auto and steel and all of that. You didn't have to have a high school graduation diploma either. And so, especially in the black community, but also white, of course, people who didn't have that education had the income and wherewithal so that they sent their kids to college and got some notches up the ladder as a consequence. Well, that all went away.
Yes. And so
I don't know, but I know that Robert Kennedy was very smart and very thoughtful and very committed to the real people. And I think, therefore, he would have figured out with advice and so on, a better strategy than what we did have. And, you know, what we did have was not a heck of a lot. And the corporations started pushing back. The unions started being attacked. There were attacks on regulation because the corporations were feeling squeezed as a result of everything I'm saying. So that regulations they sat still for, they wanted to get rid of them because they were part of the thing that was raising the cost of things. And so we don't know, but and we certainly have to put that into our thinking because it's the heart of where we are in terms of electing Donald Trump. I mean, this is a direct descendant of that that's going on now with the people who whose jobs didn't come back after the Great Recession here a few years back. And, you know, they'd sort of seen this whole thing happening, but gradually, and all of a sudden after the end of the Great Recession and others went back, they just saw that they were left out, and they're furious. And they, as far as they were concerned, both parties had let them down, and Trump was something different, and they would try him. So that's all tied together.
Now, we only have a few minutes left, and we were talking offline. You mentioned your grandchildren, who obviously wouldn't have been born during Bobby Kennedy's lifetime, or even your children, I guess, for that matter. But what do you tell them about Bobby Kennedy when they ask? Well, what would you tell anyone who didn't know Bobby Kennedy?
Yeah,
Bobby Kennedy matters. Why?
Yes, my first son is Joshua Robert Edelman, and then there's Jonah Martin Edelman. What I would tell them is that this is a man who absolutely cared about everybody, and especially people who were marginalized, and who really wanted to make this a better world. That he was deeply committed to do something really to make a difference every day. What he did yesterday was yesterday, and today, what are we going to do to make a difference? So this sense of values and commitment and respect for everyone and connecting with people, and have it be truly about peace in our world and in economic justice, all kind of justice, racial in our country. That's what I would tell them.
And for those you who may not be familiar, even though the campaign ended on June 5th, 1968, Professor Edelman has continued to fight these last 50 years in his work, both in law and his work in terms of seeking peace in Israel and elsewhere. And so you definitely look him up. He's someone who I'm very proud to know, and who's really fought the fight these last 50 years. I do have to get in one last question. Bobby Kennedy had a daughter who was born after he died. So his youngest actually was born after he died. And in 2015, I believe, she was nominated for an Oscar for her film On the Last Days in Vietnam as a documentary filmmaker. And your youngest, a year later, actually won the Oscar for that same category. So that's one more similarity you two have.
Well, thank you. Rory's wonderful, and she does great work. And of course, we just couldn't be prouder of Ezra. For those who don't know, his film was about O.J., the one that's a documentary, not the one with actors. And so, yes, thank you for mentioning that, Ben.
Thank you. So we're out of time, Professor. Thank you very much. It's been a great honor, and thanks again for all of the work you've done. Join us next week for another edition of CyberLaw and Business Report. We'll be talking about toxic Twitter right here. Check us out on Twitter at CyberLaw Radio. Take care, everyone. Have a great week.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.